Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
And this is Jakob, and this is a podcast where the co-hosts do a deep read of each episode of The Wire, the hit show.
That's right. Anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support in case you want to throw us any money in our last few weeks here. Let's get right into it. We're continuing on with season 5, and we're at episode 8, Clarifications, and we find ourselves back in Comstat.
Oh, that's that. lots of stuff going on there. Rawls is into the kink once in a while. That's the main takeaway, right?
Yeah, he's commenting on how the supposed serial killer likes to bite his victims and making a joke about it. And yeah, it's one of like the rare instances where, you know, Jimmy probably never thought he would be in like a position where he would be having to speak so articulately and like convincing some of the upper management that like he needs resources. But they're all, it's a very like friendly atmosphere between all of them. Like, yes. The ironic thing is that it's totally predicated on this big lie that Jimmy is spreading.
You lied on the stats.
Yeah, this is like the most calm stat meeting, yeah, we've seen throughout the series run.
And yeah, add that to the, you know, we'll add calm stat to the app submissions with along with Marlo talking to Prop Joe, who will be missed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's funny how it's all one big lie. It's funny. But yeah, they're like, you know, Carchetti doesn't even like, he just got frustrated. Partially, I mean, because of the situation, and then he just said, "Sure, whatever you want to take, just you know, any resources you need." But also, he was probably a little bit like taken aback or disappointed based on the last Comstat, you know, he went to, right? Because he sat in before, right?
He sat in on a Comstat meeting, and like this was when Daniels and Rawls were grilling some, we're in the middle of grilling somebody. Like, he was still the mayor elect at that point, right? He wasn't yet mayor.
So I mean, but he was like, this is boring, man. We don't want to hear this stupid cop talk about this like really annoying situation.
Yeah, I mean, Tommy's like in the middle of his you know, he's full on committed to his gubernatorial run now, so he's just like always looking towards the next thing and just interested in what's politically expedient for himself. And he's not even paying attention to the issues at hand. Like, he's just like, ah, oh, whatever. I'm giving you some money. Figure it out. Okay. Yeah. Schools. Let me cough up.
Yeah, exactly. And Rawls says something about the, about that when he, states kind of, you know, like, he's proud of the fact that the mayor needs police more than schools. So, but what's your take on that? I mean, is that a out of the ordinary?
Yeah, I don't. I mean,
come on, let's crunch some numbers here. No, but I mean, yeah, isn't that always the case, where they say it or not? Like,
yeah, I mean, I guess the only difference is that this is going to get a lot more publicity shed on it, and perhaps, I don't know. But like,
Look at this chart here, the city budget of X city. I mean, the city we live in, or I live in. Okay, you're in the Northeast.
We're in the same county.
Okay, I got some clarification from native Angelinos, and I guess it is claimed like borderline. Depends who you're talking to. Like Glendale, Gary, definitely Nela.
Yeah, Northeast Los Angeles.
Can I talk to you? Hey, girl. Can I talk to you? I've had a really bad diet. Nah. Anyways, that's neither here nor there. But I mean, at least like half the city budget's for the cops or more, right?
Yeah.
So I'd imagine school is not like, you know, going to, there's no way the math could work. But just because all the money's not thrown at it doesn't mean that they don't need it more.
Right.
No, they don't need it. They don't care.
But it's so interesting because at the beginning of this season, you see the police departments basically in tatters, but he sold out the schools as well. So just everybody's suffering at that point. And yeah, now the inequality is going to be even more so on display. McNulty throws a little bit of a curveball at the brass when he decides to include Carver in on a lot of his goings about, even though he doesn't reside in one of the districts where the supposed serial killer committed his crimes. And there's only one response Carver has to that bizarre request.
This is some fucked up McNulty shit. Yeah. I don't know why that made you so. Yeah. I mean, he knows, but it does show, I guess, the growth. I mean, we've talked about it, so it's not like, oh, you know, that's all this episode is just one clarification.
Yeah.
Or as you would say, apology, Jakob. You're gonna make an apology episode for all the things you said, you non-committal freak.
That was a joke.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know. Yeah, but who would have thought that he would be wanted, right? You know, for something like this. But I mean, okay, maybe it doesn't have to just do with his growth. Like McNulty's seen him in the field. You know, he knows how. How hardcore he can get, but
and they both probably definitely have dirt on each other probably. Yeah. So there's like a kind of mutual understanding there.
Yeah, Carver's like, I'm gonna get my guy Herc and we're just gonna confront Marlo in his meeting area at the park on Landvale and Mosher, where we almost got beat up once. Round two.
Yeah, but it's interesting that Daniel's, you know, he's the victim of Carver's growing pains more than anybody. And even he is, you know, agreeable on that front. So, yeah, some good growth all the way around, even if that does mean that Carver is going to be taking part in a operation that's predicated on a horrible lie. So in other police news, McNulty and Greggs are summoned to the Quantico building for some FBI profiling or some help with their resources. And this gets into a little scene where they're being, you know, debriefed or whatever about the FBI's profile, the serial killer, but it's like interrupted by the deputy director. And I wrote that, like, this dialogue comes off almost like an SNL sketch at this point. Yeah, where it kinda just seems like, it seems so bizarre that, like, and, like, out of place for this, like, emotionally insecure FBI deputy director to come in and, like, basically beg these detectives to validate him for his television news appearances and his book deals and stuff. And, like, he's even talking about, like, oh, yeah, like, the creative team at CSI contacts me for a lot of that information. Is this
F&G?
This is David Simon just getting in a dig at crime scene like those types of shows and stuff.
Yeah, but we don't have time for that weak CSI stuff here. We got a lab in Baltimore that looks like your high school chemistry class.
That's
great. It's like just waiting for your teacher, like, just don't even mix those fluids. You want to write a extra credit essay on soda pop? Jesus. Sick burn. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm losing it here.
Yeah, it's crazy, bro. Anyways, yeah, that was pretty bizarre, wasn't it?
Yeah, it just felt like it was just like, in an otherwise perfect episode, it was a rare detour into the absurd. it is neat that the FBI agent bodies McNulty without him even realizing it by describing like all the personality characteristics of this serial killer, just like,
dude. And like, I mean, spoilers here maybe, but some IMDb trivia. I mean, you kind of buried, I mean, you know, you nailed it, but you know, like you said, who's the you know, serial killer, like what is the description mirroring here? Yeah, it's like you said, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely, they're definitely talking about McNulty, and McNulty is realizing it and starting to realize that maybe he's not the hero that he thought he was.
Yeah, this kind of hits him hard because then he goes home and he's like, I live here?
Yeah.
At Beatty's house? I'm like, wait, he's still allowed there?
Yeah, I was just, I was just assuming he was catting around, you know. Him and Kima still have too much dog in them to settle down, supposedly. Like, I figured he was just...
Do you think when people use that, like, I got dog in me, like, do you think, because isn't dog like a slang for, like, you know, some hardcore stuff?
Oh, I don't know too much about that. I always, like, cocaine?
No, like... That's girl, right? Dog is like,
oh, heroin.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
But she meant it like she's like, out. Yeah,
she's sexually promiscuous with lots of different women.
Okay.
But she's a good auntie.
Yeah, she's really connecting with
is Cheryl's kid.
Yeah, is that her real kid? And like, was she really pregnant?
I think Melanie Nichols,
because I see a very stark resemblance with Melanie Nichols King.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that
I got some dog. Oh wait,
that's the real son.
Yeah, that was brutal, man.
Yeah,
but yeah, like I said, he's at Beatty's house, and then she wrote some like note, like, I might be back, or I might be.
Yeah, she's getting all cute. She's thinking she's a poet writing a breakup letter.
And then, like, you write a breakup letter, and then you just come back from, like, your kid's Little League practice or something, and they're like, Mom, I want a snack. And you're like, damn, I almost had it. Like, I almost played this off, but I only have one house. And this guy's still allowed here.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to take McNulty's side or anyone's side. Like, Beatty's well within her right, obviously, to do whatever she wants. Like, she says, it's my house. Like, I built this on, like, taking kickbacks of VCRs from the docks. Oh, wait, never mind. No, that was a good job she had. She still has that job?
Yeah, she's still poor police.
Yeah, but... poor police.
Yeah.
Now I'm patrolling the Under Armour plant down in Port Covington. Got some merch. Not for you, McNulty. You are off brand sneakers. Okay, never mind.
Got him.
Man.
You right there?
Yeah, I'm good. McNulty said this, right? You start to tell the story, and you're the hero, and then when you get done talking,
and it's interrupted because she closes the door on him. And if that wasn't humiliating enough, we have, of all people, Barlow extorting him, riding like he wants to get paid to go on like a golfing weekend getaway, like, and disguise it as overtime for solving a quote unquote transvestite murder in the Carolinas. And it's just so ironic that Barlow, the dumbest cop that we've his brain is pressure treated. One of the dumbest cops we've seen on this show is like the one to figure out that Jimmy is vulnerable and there's more to the story than he's leading on, and he successfully extorts him.
Yep. Well played, man. I mean, with those tactics, you'd imagine his contracting empire is vast and that he's probably quite a skillful slumlord.
Yeah, he's greedy, trying to get more money when he's already got a successful deck building business.
Yeah, he's had a pressure treated. I gotta hit. Bring my 9-iron to Hilton Head. Good stuff. Have you ever played Hilton Head? Broke ass McNulty. Yeah. You don't even own Under Armour gear.
Yeah.
Talk about gear, man. People are getting, you know, getting coming correct for the surveillance squads. You know, they're all the funding for these, you know, cops, like they've refunded BPD with the lies on the build.
Yeah.
And they got Avis and Hertz and like all new whips and stuff, and they're coming nice and fresh, and the cops just, man, it's like, let's just talk about some of the attire they have on getting ready to really nail Marlo and his crew down.
Well, Officer Bobby Brown or Robert Brown or Bob Brown Jr. or whatever.
The Enigma Bobby Brown. Is he brown? White?
Or? He's repping some of his own merch. He's wearing an off the chain t-shirt, which we could only surmise is taken from the production team of Off the Chain, the documentary he made about pit bulls and their long road to being the outcasts of society.
What is it? A shocking expose of a forsaken breed. Bobby Brown, Off the Chain.
Classic film and television footage show the popularity of what was once considered a noble and trustworthy family pet, and examines how this breed went from America's dog to public enemy number one.
Damn.
So Bobby Brown, you know, engages in, you know, casual fist fights with his fellow cops, but also a dogged animal rights advocate.
So where does this fit in the universe with cheese and his obsession with dog fighting and being, you know, in his mind, a very caring dog owner, but in reality, pretty brutal, or as brutal as it can get, you know, executing his animals. And then
euthanizing.
And then Pelicanos' obsession with wolf tickets and your obsession with reading.
Reading
E-40 and click lyrics.
Yeah.
As you black out. that's gonna be on our clarifications episode for sure, but
yeah.
Not to, you know, make amendment to, like, not to, you know, restate anything, just to really like clarify further how you know obsessed Willie can get with 90s rap lyrics and how amazing it is, like, just to highlight and double down on that.
I I was really intrigued by the use of the language on this show at times, so I wanted to dig deep. But yes, we will have a clarification of our clarifications episode.
Yeah, exactly. More like coming soon. We're getting there.
Yeah, but
until then, we're off the chain.
Yeah,
Bobby J. Brown.
That's right.
He spent 3 years infiltrating the underground subculture of pit bull fighting. Damn.
So that
great stuff. Great. Thanks for sharing all this. I have such a juvenile, like, sense of, like, you know, enchantment with his gear. Like, oh, look at this ridiculous cop. Like, who we've low key, like, been trying to figure out who he is. Like, in real life, is he really Bobby Brown from this or that or what? Like, look at his weird, like, mid-2000s cop outfit. Like, it's so stupid. And then you're coming with these, you know, these really insightful takes.
Yeah.
That's why we're doing this, man. It's
in
great.
In reality, he's just like coming up to the crew members like, hey, man, you know, like, I just made this documentary. It'd mean a lot to me if I could show off my gear.
Okay, Bobby.
A lot of great publicity.
You can wear it. Maybe in 13 years when, you know, people start binging this, you know, by stuffing their trunks with Blockbuster DVDs, well, you know, you'll see some return. See some royalties.
Nice.
If you'd like to donate to Bobby Brown's
If only I had that information handy. But Bunk finally succumbs to the realization that he needs McNulty's help in pursuing the murder of Michael's stepdad.
DeVar
Manigault, thank you for that name shout out.
But, I mean, I'm not trying to shout him out. He's baby bumper.
Yeah. Oh, man. But this is like one of those situations where, this is one of those situations where it's like Bunk has been railing against McNulty and his lie this whole season. But then in the end, he's reliant on him to get the paperwork in order to justify his going to the lab for the DNA samples that will lead him to identifying Chris Partlow as the murderer. But it's like, it's one of those questions, like, would he have been able to get this work done without all the hubbub around the serial killer? And like, would he have been forced to lie to the DNA lab fellow there that it had to do with the homeless killings, or like what? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Complex situation.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. But I feel like, I don't know, man. Just still thinking about Bobby Brown's merch. it's unfortunate that he's like, I mean, he's benefiting in some ways, but
yeah, it's
ideally icky. It's like, you can't do that, as Kimo would say.
It's an icky moral situation for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Police. Definitely an icky moral situation. But is it a depiction or endorsement of the lab work, Bunk? Bunk Lurch?
I don't think anything in this season is endorsement.
I don't think. Kimo finds out because McNulty finally has,
change of heart.
Yeah, he's like, this is getting crazy. She's really going to go through all the case files and try to make matches.
I can't have somebody doing paperwork.
Yeah, I'm the boss now.
Yeah. But, and it's a huge mistake because, as we all remember from season one, Kima is like the one cop that won't lie or, fudge the truth about anything, even if it means that it's going to make her colleagues' work easier. When Bunk was talking to her while she was on the hospital bed and getting her to identify Weebay as one of the shooters.
Yeah, man. Yeah,
so it's just characteristic that this is not information that's going to sit well with Kima. And if it's anybody that's going to, if it's any straw that's going to break the camel's back, it's going to be her.
Yep. Yeah, she's off the chain.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. That's terrible. She's, keeping it straight.
Yeah. But she's gay.
Yeah, okay. She's
great.
She's doing her thing.
She's good police.
Yeah, I guess.
But Lester...
But Lester's, man, he's
in it with the feds, like trying to justify, like, I don't understand. So in this scene where he's bringing the information about Clay Davis's lying on the mortgage applications and such.
He lied on the mortgage
application. Yeah. So Freeman's bringing that to the FBI and trying to get them to prosecute him federally, but it's a game of politics. They are upset that Bond wanted to prosecute the case himself and made Clay Davis end up looking like a martyr, and like it's the whole thing with how they were trying to screw over Carchetti in previous seasons. It's just a big political game. But like, I don't understand why Lester didn't even try to explain himself and say, like, I did try to make it federal in the first case. It's all Bond's fault. Me, I'm the one who who tried to do the right thing. Validate me. Why didn't he say that?
He should have said that.
Validate me.
I'm Lester.
That wouldn't be very smooth, I guess.
Yeah, that would be a little, that'd be like as strange or stranger than the, you all into CSI? you know? You got to write a book? No, don't write a book. Coffee? Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I don't know. You seem to have a much firmer grasp of all the inner workings of like Lester's plight here. I can't really intelligently expand upon this. It just like, you know, it's just, he hasn't lost like people skills being down in the basement all this time? Probably not. I mean, you know, it's just a bureaucracy. He's over it. He's just like, I'm on my way out. Like, I don't give a shit.
And the more that I think about it and conversing about this with you is that...
me?
Yes.
conversing with me.
Perhaps you have a point there when you say that, like, he's done with the bureaucracy and he's on his way out.
Wow, yeah. I got a point.
But that, like... He's probably like already concocting this scheme even when he's in the office to like somehow blackmail Clay Davis or whatnot in the later scene when he's in the bar. So, I mean, that's basically what he's doing with him, like threatening him with the federal prosecution, even though there's no possibility of one. He's just like trying to get Clay Davis to cooperate so he can go down the line of all the different big money movers.
Yeah. Says we got an update. Sorry. Well, he had a pop up as soon as he finished the. Like,
it's like a little.
Hammer that home. It's just like. Doo, doo, doo.
I'm the real virus.
You're the real. I mean, I guess you could say that old Clay has two of his schemes in the club, and he knows that Lester knows about each lie. Oh yeah, sorry, that's a terrible rendition to my in the club song by artist from LA, TY Dollar Sign. Clay can relate to that though. I mean, Freeman really just, I mean, he's strategic with this, waiting until he's like out on his date or whatever, like, he's doing.
What does he say to his date to convince her just to like walk away for a minute?
He's like,
some real smooth. Yeah.
Shit. I mean, he's, so he's threatening that he's going to give a call to the U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
Who's like, above the state's attorney, but below the fed attorney.
I'm not sure what it is with all the, titles and stuff. I just feel like he's bullshitting him in this. I mean, he's kind of bullshitting him in this instance just to get him to spill the tea.
Or the, blood. Teeny. Martini. Stirred.
But Sidner, so Lester, like
Sidner.
Yeah, Lester has some good stuff going on, but Sidner is also should also get some kudos.
More like Sid Nerd with his maps.
Ooh, that's a good one there. Yeah, Sidner gets some kudos for decoding the intricate messaging system that Marlo and co are using.
Who would have thought that they play not only I'm assuming chess down at their meeting spot, but like Risk or something? Because where did Marlo and them get the idea? Like, how does it line up with their map? Like, do they just have maps in their meeting spot, or how does it correlate with like the cops are like 35, that's this map grid? So how does Marlo, like, was he or someone like in the army too? I don't know.
I just figure that I mean, they've already kind of like touched upon on this show that the criminals are so smart at coming up with like all these different codes that like Marlo rising through the ranks, going through all these different crews and gangs when he was when he was a young person, probably just like picked up on different ways to use codes and whatnot, and probably was inventive along the way and came up with his own way of communicating.
Yeah, but who knows? That's true, man. I mean, yeah, so.
Linwood Rudy Williams, did you ever use clock-like text messages to communicate meeting locations? Give us a shout-out. We'll give you a 5-star review on your book. On
Amazon. We still got to read. We still got to do like a little book review club. Ooh. Talk about Patreon. That I've always wondered, like, how would we come up with enough content? Not that our episodes aren't like 2 hours, well, they're shorter now, thankfully, but where are we going to find content? Okay. That was another 2.5 hour recording. Really struggling here.
Yeah. Let's do book reviews of Linwood Rudy Williams.
We got to.
Power Moves. Is that?
Yeah, I think. Who needs to watch Power when you could just read Power Moves by the real. I mean, they're up in Northwest where I think Rudy's like some of his people were. Well, as Willie points to the map, Northwest. Yeah, because Sidner's not familiar with the Northwest, like Edgecombe, where that lady is. She's like, I'm up on Palmall, which actually kind of weirdly ties in because part of the trivia is that for this episode is guess who one of the kids was who was imitating Omar at that shootout.
Yeah,
that was supposedly on Pall Mall or something. So it's like similar with Marlo. I don't know, confusing. But the more I hear the cops talking Geo, and the more people, you know, in my life want to make little jokes about how, oh, you're really a fed, like you're always searching these weird topics out and going down these rabbit holes and mapping things and tracking YouTube comments.
I don't even know if they know the view delving into these map beefs from centuries past.
Yeah. The map. Okay, that's funny though, because that's not like 12 stuff. Yeah. Why do they call them 12? Didn't make the cut. But anyways, yeah. I mean, he and Lester are doing their weird. Like tracking, so pretty crazy stuff, man.
Yeah.
All that lack of literacy in the schools. Apparently, though, you know, like geography, always something important that they never taught in school. So, like, in a roundabout way, congrats to Marlo and his crew for really embracing it, you know?
Yeah. And speaking of geography and geographical locations, one particular location that Marlo seems to be obsessed with is Atlantic City and going there to party.
Oh, my God. That was great. I love that geo transition.
So it's like...
Man, yeah, persistent, right?
I mean, we're jumping around a little bit here, but...
I mean, if you've seen this episode, you know there's one like... very important and sad event.
Yeah. So Marlo completely like laughs aside the notion, like it's all like, I mean, you know, you have to consider that Marlo is unaware at this point that Omar has been going all throughout Baltimore calling Marlo a bitch and not a man for this town. And like, Omar is asking Marlo to step to him. He doesn't know all that at this point, but he like, you would think like he would like want to take it upon himself to like take Omar out or like have somebody from his crew do the job. But like, he's relieved that a little kid has just like done the gig for him and like basically doesn't have like any real like, I mean, I guess he was slinging for him, but Kennard doesn't have like that strong of a connection to like the higher ups in the Stanfield organization. So it kind of absolves him from like any kind of criminal prosecution, but also he doesn't have to pay the bounty money for like little Kennard. Like he's not giving him like 200,000 or whatever he was offering. He's going to use that money to go to Atlantic City.
Kennard's like, you guys want to go to Petco and buy some more cats? Sorry.
Yeah. I'm doing.
That's a great point. More money for what one would, what does Marlowe spend his excess, like his bounty savings on in AC? I mean, does he gamble?
What does Chris spend that on? Like, he seems even more like, I mean, Marlowe's smiling a little bit in this scene, but I mean, Chris does nod in like agreement that they will go to Atlantic City together, it's not one of happiness.
He's like, Chris, you know, the economic downturn, like that's just occurred in AC. I mean, they got a lot of things being boarded up. There's vacants there too. Pit boss, what did you say to my guy?
Research. It's a research. It's a business trip.
Yeah, exactly. I really am upset. There was no sixth season just so we could have maybe seen like the get together in AC.
Yeah,
but who knows, man? We can dream, right?
Well, Chris will be in jail. Chris is in jail at the end of the.
That's true, but who knows? Maybe like, God, don't steal my dreams here. Like, maybe I don't know. Marlo at least could have gone and just like thought about Chris dreamily from the beach.
Yeah,
and yeah, killed it on the craps table because he's a businessman. But yeah, I mean, let's get into this. I mean, this is a monumental scene. Completely surprised me the first time that was Kennard. I mean, obviously Omar's been out of character and putting himself in very risky situations, already compromised physically, and I'm sure mentally exhausted, and knows that something. The fist fight he always wanted with Marlo probably was never going to come to fruition regardless.
Yeah.
Kennard is hard.
Omar walks by in the midst of Kennard trying to set a cat on fire and does
Jesus. And this is what we were talking about from the corner, not to just want to bring up like the negative aspects of like people's story arcs and stuff, especially given DeAndre's no longer around, like to defend himself if it wasn't actually something that was going on. But I think a long time ago I said, like, I don't know what we were talking about, and kind of like doing a little in memory of DeAndre McAuliffe. And I'm like, let's just say Kennard trying to light that cat on fire probably wasn't like something that they just wrote out of nowhere, like, because I remember some pretty crazy stuff they used to do to cats in the corner like that, or messing with their, like, coop or something.
Damn.
Like, torturing them or something, so. Pretty, just like, alley activities, for 12-year-olds or 11, 10.
Yeah.
Super small canard.
Yeah. I mean, but as we pointed out many times before, they've been setting it up all this time that Omar was going to fall in a rather anticlimactic fashion at the hands of a kid who had once idolized him for his reputation.
Trivia, man.
Yeah, because in season 3...
Sorry.
When Bunk goes to visit the scene of where...
Tasha?
Was killed. Thank you. He does see Kennard proclaiming, it's my turn to be Omar now, while they fight with imaginary guns and whatnot. So, and Kennard has always been like one of the most like verbally brutal characters on the show, proclaiming Omar's a gimpy motherfucker. Telling people to put me down, fuck, like
to just, Bobby Brown.
Just like he's been really Taliso Dingwall?
Taliso, I'd imagine. Or
Taliso Dingwall is a great actor.
Yeah.
And it's totally believable that he would be the one to kill Omar.
Yeah, and he's shocked, you know, Kernard, the character, is shocked when he commits, you know, the murder. And I mean, that moment where he, you know, is like, has that look on his face, obviously, of like horror, kind of the gravity of the situation, and then just points the gun at the
shopkeeper.
Yeah, that's like a stroke of genius. Like, because you could read it so many ways. Like, you know, that's something Kennard would do, even in the face of being like horrified with, oh, I just blew this guy's head off, and then being like, shut up. But then also just, you know, the panic of the moment, just kind of like, what do I do next? Like, do I shoot her too? Or what do I run? Do I, you know?
Those survival instincts are still kicking in, even in the face of trauma.
Yeah, but then let's talk about trauma.
Oh, yeah.
The kid actor, Taliso Dingwall, pretty brutal background on this whole
scene. Crying in the midst of filming it, right?
Yeah, I remember reading from All the Pieces Matter.
Yeah.
It's been a while since we, you know, have moved on from seasons where we literally had an entire section of the show, each episode featured. But it wasn't just about the book, right?
Yeah.
But it was inspired, maybe.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, he was really shaken by this whole scene.
Michael K. Williams had to reassure him that he was okay.
Yeah, I'm not. It's R.I.P.
Yeah.
But yeah, that whole situation, I mean, being a minor, his parents, I remember, were already not necessarily pleased at all the lines he had to say, even if, you know, he was really brilliant in his portrayal of Kernard. So,
but this is, you know, it kind of mirrors the scene where Wallace got killed and Michael B. Jordan was going through some emotional times
just and
with that scene being filmed.
It's just that, I mean, did we go into some of the stuff maybe Mr. Taliso worked on after this? Or because I was going to say, like, well, and then they went different paths. Like,
I think we did talk about it, yeah.
And then you were like, no, I need a clarification. This is what I don't want to disrespect. But pretty tough. And then I remember also, I think, was it Dennis Lehane or a writer was saying how, like, you know, this is how it always had to be.
Yeah.
Just some like random kid almost. I mean, not random in the context of the show to like, you know, non-casual fans, but
fuck them.
Casual viewers.
Yeah.
Hey, donate to our page. Even if you're just learning like so much new stuff from our page, if you're listening to this, you're, like we always say, you're not an average viewer. You're an extraordinary listener.
Yeah, there you go.
And very patient. This is ridiculous. So anyways, crazy stuff to know about.
Yeah.
Glad we did this.
Yeah.
I would have never read all the I don't know. I probably would have.
To keep going on about, you know, the chaotic nature of like in everyday life, how Omar would just get killed at the hands of a little kid. Like, he's already like tempted fate so many times throughout this show, including up to the very moment when he dies, when he walks up to Truck and Dozerman with the shotgun and gets them to like preemptively like arrest people around the corner that he doesn't want to come into contact with.
Open carry Omar.
Thank you.
Gangster down to the end.
Yeah.
But they're just enjoying snowballs. I think I made a really dumb comment a long time ago where I was like, snowballs at one of those like police or like West Side community meetings.
Yeah.
And it's like obviously a Baltimore staple and like trademark, the snowballs, like you buy as if you would, you know, like here in California, ice cream from like one of those.
I've had snowballs before though.
Oh, really? Like out here?
Yeah. And just like the ice with the flavored syrup on it.
Oh, okay. But I don't want to, I mean, sure. You want to, if you're confident that that's the authentic, like what they have in Baltimore, go for it, man. I don't want to get in the middle. I mean, I'm such a, you know, my apology episode's coming soon. That's okay. Nah, but.
I'll have one right after that too.
Yeah. Like you got another snowball?
No, apology episode. But I was going to say, you're going to have to pay for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, you want to hear us walk it back? No.
No, but.
Yeah, crazy stuff there with those two because they were just like amazed by a Garmin or some type of really early GPS.
Yeah, TomTom or whatever they're called.
Oh, TomTom. Yeah, Tank.
Yeah, what do they have, like Siri XM or something, or like some satellite radio? But I find it amusing.
Siri XM, yeah.
Yes, I find it amusing. I yes. find it amusing that Dozerman is so enthralled with this GPS capability in his car, and he's like bragging about, you know, like, oh, I hope we never catch this guy. Like, we're getting so much OT. Like, this is amazing. This is luxury. But Sidner is the one that cracks the code because of good old-fashioned police work on some paper maps. He doesn't need a GPS because...
It's in my map.
Yeah. It's in my map! Marlowe's code, that is. Or the legend.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and also it's just... speaks to the conversation surrounding how out of touch these type of cops are. That they don't recognize like the most prolific stick of man and notorious guy Omar, which you know, it's a common theme in the episode. But just one thing before we move on, I could have had a really nice transition there, but instead I'm like, I gotta get to my map beast. because Omar says, you know, there's these two boys on, you know, they got a strap on them or they got weaponry, you know, they're on Fulton and Lex, I'm assuming Lexington in West Baltimore, but very clearly in the background on the intersection that they're parked on, it says probably like 700 North Castle, which is way on the east side. So they really would have had to use that GPS to get around. That's a long drive to Fulton. Okay, I get it. It's, you know, it's great. It's a great show. Still better than just about everything on TV these days. I mean, live sports are fun, but party's over.
If there was sorry about the 49ers not getting into the Super Bowl.
To know.
But if there was some real fan service going on in this instance in the episode, Bunny would have just showed up out of nowhere and thrown a compass at Dozerman.
Where are you?
Okay, so do we want to move on to a little bit about what's going on in the City Hall situation and...
Evil Budget Steintorf. Evil Budget Willie. I mean, Evil Budget Prez.
Yeah.
He's like saying, you know, you basically something to the effect of, you know, the scores are out. You know, it is what it is. Like school-wide testing and all that. State Maryland's MSA is that like Maryland State
Assessment.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I think yeah.
But like you're screwed if crime doesn't go down.
Yeah.
Because that's, you know,
you need
to, all about the stats.
Yeah. You need to show up at the vigil with a bunch of homeless people who look uncomfortable in front of the media and cameras and make a really great speech. So we could further, validate your desire to run for governor. Oh wait, Maurice Dobie is considering primarying you because you were kissing up too much to Steny Hoyer and all these other white guys. And you need to embrace diversity and, you know, talk more to the people in PG County and give us some love.
You don't want to go to Pretty Girl County?
And, you know, almost, you know, 14 years after this episode aired, we can like reflect on like how things have changed in politics and, you know, how things Oh, wait, Steny Hoyer is the leader, or is the House Majority Leader. Never mind. It's still the same.
Yeah.
No.
Sorry. That's clever, man.
Sorry. I didn't. I buried the lean. Or, yeah. No, I. No.
You buried the build. But, you know, Carchetti has ways around this, right? Because yeah. He's just going to enlist Clay.
He's going to enlist Clay to do, he's going to give him two spots on the liquor board.
Clay to play, man. Yeah. Man, that's, so how many, I should, in our extensive research of places like El Dorado, the real Desperado, and, you know, all the adult, like, gentlemen clubs in Baltimore, we should know, like, how many spaces are on the liquor board and how it, is something that's like very manipulated and yeah. Also very coveted, you know,
yeah.
Coveted spot in the city, like the power dynamics. Cause you know,
yeah.
gotta be able to, I'm sober. Okay. But that liquor, you know, it's important.
Yeah, you know? It is important. It's going to make money. And Tommy knows that Clay is corrupt and has even cut him loose before the whole prosecution went down. And their friendship was essentially, or like their uneasy alliance was like, you know, essentially over at that point, where Tommy just indicated that he wasn't going to help in the prosecution at all. But now that he's a free man and Clay Davis is, you know, saying blatantly hypocritical statements like, oh, Maurice Dobie is playing the class or the race card. That's shameful.
That's some shameful shit.
Tommy has to rely upon him yet again to advance his own political standings. And it's just now he's endorsing Nerisse Campbell for mayor potentially instead of Bond because Bond was too stupid to take the thing federal. It's all just like a big mishmash of corruption and glad handing, if that's a term.
I've learned a lot of new terms from you here in this last year or two.
But yeah, it's all gross. Like the whole city hall political thing is now just as corrupt as like Marlowe.
Whoa.
No, it's
yeah,
not.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not that bad, but this show is always trying to get us to pay attention to the parallels. Like the whole thing with, you know, Omar going crazy in his final days can be seen as like a parallel to McNulty just like totally going off the rails this season.
Yeah, so. Because liquor is, spots on the liquor board is like spot, like having a seat at the co-op, man. The liquor is the heroin, man.
I mean, okay. I mean, I
think about the trickle down and the effect it will have on stevedore bars. Oh,
I mean, I get that you're kind of taking a dig at me.
No, I would never.
But Clay,
it's true. It's just like the more high class, like accepted form yeah. of the dope.
Exactly, and Clay Davis. Literally, I mean, he is like the only character to sit and talk comfortably both with the gangsters, the politicians, and some, I guess the police universally pretty much hate him, but he talks to gangsters and politicians in equal measure, and Carchetti by this point is eating it all up because it's all, you know, in a... It's some shameful shit because he's just using it to advance his own position.
Yeah. Clay talks to gangsters so he can get on liquor boards to get closer to strippers.
Hmm. Yeah.
Gangsters, strip. Everyone has a too short story.
Yeah. The talking to gangsters to get to strippers pipeline.
Because that's all he... messes with. No, I'm just, I don't know what he,
yeah,
I don't, but, I mean, he's not like, you know, that was Orlando.
Yeah.
Like who else is on the liquor board? Is Fat Face Rick? No.
I don't know.
I don't know. Gotta do some digging.
Yeah.
Talk about like the newsroom.
Sure.
That's where it all starts and ends this season.
Yeah.
Kind sure. of. I mean, you know, not a cop show, is it? No.
It's a humanist show.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we talked about the police enough.
Yeah.
Gus says they don't care about homelessness really while they're smoking on the dock, loading dock.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, stevedore hang out, like how they used to hang out on the dock.
Some parallels, man.
They're like, yeah, man. But they don't really have a, unfortunately, they didn't have their own bar, really, did they? You kind of would just go to like cop bars or they would go out for a drink together, but.
Yeah, we don't really see the news reporters getting schwasty faced. Maybe. Well,
Gus likes to have, I mean, he likes to have a few because he's telling the Marine that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, you know, when you have a taste, you know, people say things. And Mr. Manning, was that his name?
Yeah.
AKA Gunny Swore from
Dan Racing Kill.
Yeah. Shout out Ziggy's Duck, yeah. As always. And yeah, I mean, there's some things you don't ever fuck with them, you know. Yeah. That's what Manning's saying in response to his beef with Scott, who's, you know, obviously on his fake trout graphs.
Yeah, Gus, I mean, with this Marine coming forward and specifically spelling out how Scott is lying on the build in his
lied on the guild of writers.
You're lying on what is it? You're lying on the troop or what?
You lied on the field on the way to Fallujah.
Yeah. So, Gus pretty much, has it spelled out for him that Scott is a fake trout, with the messing up of this story, and then with him at the candlelight vigil, obviously making up a quote from an unnamed homeless woman when there are plenty of homeless people there who would want to be interviewed. So Scott is full, like, you know, if there was any trepidation from the last episode about if he was going to go full in on Scott being a fake trout, this is... You know, the training wheels are off, the boxing gloves are off in this episode.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, he's got the backing of the Metro desk editor, who's probably someone we should know. Do you know who he was?
Sorry. Oh,
okay. Yeah. I didn't mean to, you know, don't ever apologize to me again.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's getting, he's making a stand in public.
Yeah.
And it seems like a lot of people are like, okay.
We got a standard and I'm going to follow it. Yeah. Chocolate milk, not coffee.
Yeah, exactly. So what's up with Gus's office or his desk computer, his monitors displaying something?
I don't know. I just thought it was funny that earlier on in this episode, they were lamenting him and Bill Zorzi and... something Price, I can't even remember the first name of that particular reporter character. They were lamenting the fact that they're probably going to have to be writing about this homelessness situation until December because they're all aiming for Pulitzer Prize consideration. And I didn't even think about this, but I did notice there is a quote taped to Gus's office computer that says, "Many are trapped for hours in darkness and confusion." And so I did a little digging on Reddit and discovered that that's a real headline from a 1993 New York Times article about the World Trade Center bombings. And apparently the staff of the New York Times in that year won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on the World Trade Center. So
ooh-wee.
Wondering if that's just, you know, that headline is the standard that Gus holds himself to, like, yes, one of these days I'm gonna. But then again, he doesn't really seem concerned with pride. Maybe this is an example of the type of writing not to do, because Scott does end up winning a prize, so he thinks it's all a sham, and he just wants to have that constant reminder to himself, like, no, I don't care about this awards bullshit.
It's great. Who insight. Knows?
But I just thought yeah. it's something I've wondered about, and so I just wanted to bring it into the light. Now y'all can discuss amongst yourselves.
Thank you. And talking about light, that's the street Bubble sells newspaper on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like a little something positive maybe happening in the, as far as reporting goes.
Right.
With
yeah.
Fletcher, like, coming to Gus was like, you know, real life, some true tales of the city,
right?
Dickensian stuff, in like a roundabout way or not.
Yeah,
I don't know. But anyways, like, you know, Bubbles, not to like get sidetracked from the newsroom stuff, but you know, like, it's pretty well known, you can discuss amongst yourselves that, you know, Dookie's going to be obviously the next Bubbles, and then, you know, as Bubbles is pulling himself out of the basement, crossing that threshold eventually, Dookie is pretty much, you know, on his pathway into
A-rapping.
Being trapped in darkness and confusion for many, I'm assuming, years.
Yeah.
Because he meets the A-rabber after getting stood up by Poot, of all people, at Jacob's shoes store. Because
yeah.
That slumlord manager won't hire anyone who's under 17. Seems like discriminatory. I mean, yeah. Can't you get a work permit at 15? Or?
Yeah.
Whoa, dude.
That was a jinx. But yeah, and I also love, like, so yeah, it's tragic that Duke, I mean, not tragic, but it's just like Dookie is obviously really brilliant and a bright student and could have adjusted to high school if he, you know, was just pushed more in that direction to actually go and deal with the fears of being around like older, bigger kids. But it's like, you know, he probably could have set his sights higher on being than on being an A-rabber.
Yeah.
But also, I love Poot's advice to him. He's like, yeah, just like go out on them corners and deal drugs for like another year or two and then come back when you're ready. Like,
yeah.
You need a, you know, a good felony conviction or a rap sheet. Like, that'll go good on your resume.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
we need references.
Like, he hasn't seen firsthand how badly it ends for very young people. Like, I'm optimistic.
Death. Yeah.
It's like the fact that you'd be looking for a job as, you know, a shoe salesman proves that you're well suited to survive extremely long time in like corner years. 2 years is like, what, probably just as much like as like an average lifespan out there.
Yeah. Not the best advice, Poot.
Yeah. I mean, but hey, you know. If you're looking for a solid videographer or someone who can edit content for a long-term commitment, Trey Chaney should be your guy. You hear that, Van?
Yeah.
I was just on the Twitters, and then, Van Lathan was talking about, you know, how he wants someone for a long-term, like, commitment for content. Oh. And Trey Chaney responded, like, look no further, boss, or something to the effect of that. Like, I got you, man.
Damn,
you need me. Because he's positive, man. Trey's corner, baby. You keep grinding, you could be a shoe salesman someday, Willie. We could, like, we just got to get back on these corners.
Yeah.
And we'll be at Big Five in no time.
And then I'll be a real dedicated father.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll be one day. Yeah. Shout out to dedicated fathers.
Yeah.
Give him flowers. We're almost there.
Yeah. But yeah, so...
Jesus.
Yeah. We have the news of Omar's death reaching, well, not even reaching the newsroom, because Gus doesn't even want his homicide printed in the newspaper, and favors, you know, a fire over the death of the legend of the streets. You know,
a Charles County fire, which is like not even city, like that's not even Baltimore City. That's so messed up.
This is David Simon wagging his finger at us, just like he did in that talk at, was it UC Berkeley or USC?
Yeah.
Where he's like quizzing them on like, what's, you know, what's the real meaning of season 5?
Oh yeah,
five?
That's USC, man. Those, I mean, come on. Yeah. UC students wouldn't fall for that, man. we're out here in Kerr Hall, man.
But yeah,
occupying. So,
yeah, the talk at USC is like, what's the real meaning of season 5?
Oh, well, I think it's...
No, you're really close.
What's your major? How many lawyers? Oh, business majors. Oh, okay. Oh, it says a lot.
But yeah, the whole fact that Proposition Joe's name didn't really make a big splash in the newspaper, and Omar won't even be mentioned, even though he's like on the tip of like everybody's tongue who we've been following throughout these past 5 seasons. And also that his name tag is mixed up in the morgue.
Yeah, with some random white dude.
Yeah. Human life matters less and less. We're not paying attention to the real stories. Omar died and nobody cared.
Yeah. Couldn't have said it anyway, you know, any differently. Good stuff, man. What an episode.
Yeah.
We'll be back next time with our clarifications.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you want more of our content, you could always follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The Gods Will Not Save You.
And contact us via email, thegodswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, everybody. All right, I'm going to stop recording now.